What is the perfect movie franchise? Does such a thing truly exist? The License to Watch podcast sets out to answer that age-old question. Join comedians Matt McGregor, Harris McCabe, and Colin Shaw as they dissect your favorite film franchises one movie at a time. Along for the ride is a different film industry guest for every episode. Listen as the boys play judge, jury, and executioner and decide which of your favorite movie franchises are worthy of a license to watch.
Hello, everyone. Screenplay Archaeology host Kira Midhead here. Before we get into today's episode, I just want to get some intro stuff out of the way. First things first, we are now part of the Fandom Lib Media Podcast Network, so I'm going to link their site down below. And that's why you would have just heard a promo for another podcast, because they're another one of the shows on the network. And as per usual, if you like the show and you'd like to know more, you can check out our social media pages on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and even Instagram now. The show also has a Patreon if you're willing to gift money, but you don't really need to if you don't want to. And we also have a Discord server, which you can join if you want to chat with, you know, the group members there. So that link is going to be down below as well. So yeah, sit back, guys, and enjoy the show. All right, everyone. Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Screenplay Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Kira Midhead, and tonight I'm bringing you something that's going to be a little bit different from what I've done before. I'm going to be covering a treatment, and this one is going to be of Godzilla 2, the unproduced sequel to the 1998 infamous Roland Emmerich movie. Now, it only exists in the form of a 10-page treatment, and to sort of bring that up to a reasonable episode length, instead of taking notes, I'm just going to read it verbatim. It's pretty short. It's like 10 pages, so it shouldn't be too much trouble. And the basic setup of it is that it takes the character of Nick Totopoulos from that movie and has him sort of discover the Godzilla baby that was left over at the end of it and sends it away. And then, like, a while later, there's people are getting kidnapped from places and they don't know why. And he kind of gets set on the trail for it and finds that the Godzilla baby has grown up and has had a brood of its own in the Australian outback, and that leads to a conflict with whatever else is going on. Now, to sort of make this out to feature episode length, I'm not going to talk about all the Godzilla movies, because that'll be an hour of just rambling bullshit, and I try and keep the rambling bullshit to a minimum, at least when it's just me talking. So I'm going to talk just a little bit about the history of, you know, trying to make Godzilla movies in America and where that goes before I jump into the treatment. Now, it's interesting because I've also done two episodes on this subject in the past of American Godzilla movies. Both of those are definitely material for, like, redos down the line, because I'm not happy with how either of those turned out. And I did a Patreon post where it was a written post on Patreon where I talked about, you know, their deficiencies and why I think they didn't turn out well enough. And so those are definitely ones I'll redo down the road, but I want to do them with someone so that I'm not just saying the same shit I did before, just longer. But the first time there was really any sort of attempt, like, yeah, things like a possible crossover with the 60s Batman, which that treatment also exists, and that's something that could maybe be talked about down the line. I just didn't want to do that one now. That didn't happen for various reasons, but the first attempt at really making a movie was in the early 80s when Steve Miner, who did Friday the 13th Part 2 and 3, wanted to do Godzilla King of the Monsters 3D with Fred Decker writing it. And those scripts I've reread recently, they're pretty good. Once again, that was an episode I'm not fond of because I just got lazy with that one and I didn't read both scripts. And so I was like going off of memory for what the first draft said, and it was not great. But the scripts on the whole, I think, are actually fairly solid. It would have been cool to see like a stop motion Godzilla with, you know, the early 80s level of stop motion that you saw in stuff like Empire Strikes Back, along with, like, there's supposed to be like a full-sized Godzilla head that they were going to do for close-ups that Rick Baker was supposed to build. And it would have been a cool little, like, late 70s kind of Irwin Allen disaster movie with Godzilla in it. And the Godzilla scenes are all very good. The human characters aren't bad. But unfortunately, that fell apart because no studio wanted to fund it because it would have been about 20 to 30 million, and they thought that was too expensive for what they viewed as a kid's movie. So that kind of got left to the side. And then Toho decided, hey, let's do it. Let's bring back Godzilla ourselves, because that was in the middle of the big hiatus. The first of two big hiatuses, actually, where it was 9 years between Terror of Mechagodzilla and when they brought it back with the Return of Godzilla in 84. And so Toho said, oh, let's just do it ourselves. They made the Return of Godzilla, which drew some elements from that script, interestingly enough. And then the Heisei series kicked off, and that continued for about 11 years of mostly solid movies. But then, you know, in the early 90s, they made a deal with Sony TriStar to make Godzilla, and that led into the Elliot and Rossio script that Jan de Bont was going to direct. That was my sixth episode, which I feel like I was way too nitpicky and just kind of just picking things apart into needless detail, even though I do still have issues with that script. I feel like in a better episode, like the stuff I do now, I could find a way to be more balanced about it than I was back then. I think I was just, you know, taking too much to heart the fact it was the first episode I was doing solo and felt like I had to throw in everything I could just to make an episode out of it. But that was one where they got all this pre-production work done and they were getting ready to shoot like a sequence like before production was officially supposed to begin as like a proof of concept. And then depending on who's talking, it was either budget issues or if you listen to Jan de Bont, it's because the Sony executives didn't like Godzilla, didn't like the idea of it. The idea of the movie, so they wanted to change it and make it their own, and they used the budget as an excuse. Frankly, looking at the ambition of that project with the Bont wanting to use all this CGI, like way more than was common at the time, I don't know. I think the budget might have still been a problem. But then, of course, they end up going to Roland Emmerich with the idea being like, oh, instead of the $120 million movie, you'll make it for just south of $90. And then it ended up costing $136 million. At the end of the day, not counting all the ridiculous marketing they did. So that film comes out and then just, it didn't really bomb, but it underperformed compared to what they wanted it to do. And on top of all the fucking money they spent on the ridiculous marketing, which everybody involved seems to look back on and say, wow, that was a huge mistake. They ended up not going forward with they intended a trilogy and they ended up not going forward with that. And it's a movie where I'm very mixed on it because it came out when I was six. I liked it then, and I don't mind it now. Like, it's not, like, a particularly great movie. Like, I think it has a ton of problems. Like, as a Godzilla movie, all those, that's all very well chronicled why as a Godzilla movie it doesn't work. But it's got, like, weird pacing issues. The movie stops dead in its tracks in the middle for, like, a romantic subplot that nobody who watched, even, like, the big fans of the movie don't really seem to care about that. And then it becomes about stopping the babies, and it's like, wow, you're just trying to be the Raptors from Jurassic Park, and the whole Madison Square Garden sequence. So there is fun stuff in there, like the babies tripping on gumballs. But the movie does have good stuff in it. Like, the first act is pretty good. Like, up the build-up to and Godzilla's arrival in New York, that's all pretty good. Hank Azaria is good. Jean Renault is great and should have just been the main character of the movie. And so there's good sequences in it. It's just an extreme mixed bag, in my opinion. It doesn't quite work. And then I read an article semi-recently where Dean Devlin, co-writing the movie with Roland Emmerich, and was like his common collaborator back then. They haven't done as much stuff together since. But he was talking about how they were planning a sequel, and he said, like, oh, it's going to be different. There's going to be other monsters. We're thinking about Mothra and Rodan, I think is what he said. Now, I have looked and looked for this fucking thing since I read it, and I can't find it again. It's proven very difficult to keep a hold of. And then it's like, but apparently he was talking about that, and that eventually moved aside in favor of what this treatment ended up being. And for the treatment, they bring in Tab Murphy, who has a history of working on Emmerich and Devlin-related projects. Like, I mean, he had like an Oscar nomination for his story credit on Gorillas in the Mist. He wrote and directed Last of the Dog Men, which is a movie I've always heard of but never seen, and mainly has a lot of work in animation, which is interesting because that's where the sequel to the movie ended up happening, was an animated series that got, like, what, a season and then ended. But no, most of his work is in animation, and there's some interesting stuff in here, like Hunchback of Notre Dame, which I'm not a huge fan of, but I know people like it. Tarzan, I remember being all right. Atlantis, The Lost Empire, I loved when I was a kid. I haven't seen it in a long time. Brother Bear, I haven't heard much good about. And then Superman, Batman, Apocalypse in 2010, which I remember not being that great. And Batman Year One, which I remember being okay. And then a bunch of stuff that's just kind of like episodes of animated shows. He also wrote Dark Country, which I've heard of but haven't seen. That was Thomas Jane's directorial debut that went like straight to VOD or something like that. And it's supposed to not be great, but I've never actually seen it. But yeah, it's mostly animation, including episodes of VeggieTales, interestingly enough. And the Thundercats, 8 episodes of the 2011 Thundercats show, which I've mostly heard good things about. And 2 episodes of Teen Titans Go, which that's a controversial series to say the least, along with 2 episodes of another controversial series, Be Cool Scooby-Doo, if that's the Scooby-Doo series I'm thinking of. But no, so interesting choice, and like the Devlin Emmerich stuff he worked on, like he wrote or rewrote Super Tanker, which was this disaster movie that they were like really attached to, which is something they took with them when they left Fox and moved over to Sony for Godzilla. And I've only found like the scantest description of what it's about. That's apparently like a huge oil tanker, like that's full up, that has like a full load, and gets taken over by terrorists who threaten to blow it up in San Diego Harbor or something like that. And I've never seen the script. I just have like this one sentence description of it from the greatest movies never made, or Tales from Development Hell. That's the name of the book, the David Hughes book. And it's like one little sentence in the midst of this chapter on, I think it's Fantastic Voyage. But yeah, he also did a rewrite of the Morgan and Wong Fantastic Voyage script, which Emmerich and Devlin were in talks to do. And then they left Fox, and after they left Fox, Fox brought him in, which I think is an interesting coincidence. And he also was the writer they brought in to do a rewrite of Isobar when they renamed it the Isobar Run. And that has never turned up either. Neither of those two scripts have turned up. And I'd actually really be interested in reading both of them, because the Isobar Run actually sounded very interesting in terms of a rewrite. Like, they had the whole thing taking place over the ocean instead of on land, which I thought was just like a really cool twist on what the script had set up. But to get into the treatment itself, it's called just Godzilla 2. And I have no doubt they would have changed the title before making it into an actual movie. And it's a treatment dated October 19th, 1999. So well over a year after the film had come out. So Sony was still thinking about exercising their option on making a trilogy or making more Godzilla movies well after the film's underperformance. So they were still thinking about it, at least, which is interesting. And it begins with a prologue. Godzilla is dead. Much of Manhattan lays in ruins. Not because of Godzilla, but because the military is stupid. That's me interjecting. Teams of soldiers continue to scour the creature's underground burrows, searching for any remaining eggs or baby Zillas. Life in New York is slowly returning to normal. Nick Titopoulos is invited to a warehouse where scientists from all over the world are examining Godzilla's dissected body parts. The scientist's excitement is lost on Nick, who feels increasingly distraught over the part he played in helping to destroy such a unique and intelligent life form. I don't think the movie ever implied intelligence, but that's just me. Except right, and they don't even try and make the monster sympathetic until right at the end, at the last minute, where they do the heartbeat thing, which is weirdly lifted directly from the 70s King Kong movie. That's a strange confluence of ideas there. He's haunted by memories of the final look in Godzilla's eyes just before it expired. And when he witnesses half a dozen scientists crawling over one of those extracted dead eyeballs, it's more than he can handle. He makes a quick and brusque exit after turning down an opportunity to head up the research project. That is nasty. Like, could you imagine seeing that? Like, ooh, I'm just imagining just how gooey that would look. Tortured by guilt, Nick sneaks past police barricades into the Manhattan underground to begin a search of his own, hoping against hope to discover some remnant of the now extinct species. His hopes are rewarded when he discovers one last baby Zilla trapped under some rubble and near death. Nick is able to free the baby Zilla while avoiding its jaws and claws, somehow. Although physically unhurt, the baby Zilla is weak from starvation and will die if something isn't done. Later, the butcher at the local fish market watches in astonishment as Nick buys every last piece from his display case. That's a lot of fish. I had to sneak that in there somewhere. Back in a devastated subway tunnel, Nick feeds the baby Zola and begins a relationship of trust and mutual respect that will resonate throughout the rest of the film. Voices suddenly echo from down the tunnel, a dozen flashlight beams sign an approaching squad of soldiers. Nick realizes the baby Zola will be shot on sight if found by the soldiers. Using the remaining fish as bait, Nick lures the baby Zola away. The pair manage to reach the surface without being detected. In the meantime, the baby Zola has come to believe Nick is its mother, in parentheses, imprinting. So it's, don't give me Twilight vibes. Following him everywhere like a lovesick puppy. When another squad of soldiers approaches, Nick shrouds the baby Zola in a long overcoat and shepherds it down to the waterfront. I love this mental image of a baby Godzilla in a friggin' like hat and coat, like he's Raphael from the Ninja Turtles movie. At one point, a bum accosts the pair, unwittingly begging for spare change from the baby Zilla. The bum's bloodshot eyes bulge when his extended hand is snapped at by the baby Zilla. The bum's terrified screams bring the soldiers running. That is so funny. Realizing they're about to be discovered, Nick tries to get the baby Zilla to enter the water and strike off on its own. At first, it refuses to leave its mother in quotation marks. Nick is forced to use tough love. He pushes the baby away, screams in anger, even throws rocks at it. Heartbroken, the baby Zilla finally slips into the cold water and swims off into the murky depths with mixed emotions. So it's opening with that scene from near the end of Harry and the Hendersons. Can't you see we don't want you anymore? And it's similar to, my understanding is that it's similar to how the cartoon show opens, but I think there they find an egg and the egg hatches. So this is at least a little more consistent with how the movie ended, because the movie ends with a jump scare of the egg hatching and the baby going, bah! Roll main title, Godzilla 2, Act 1. 2 years later, a series of strange and inexplicable events have begun occurring around the world. A cruise ship is found adrift off Australia with nary a soul on board. The entire population of a village on Fiji is literally vanished without trace, the village itself destroyed. An Indonesian jumbo jet is sliced in half at 38,000 feet. At the crash site, no bodies are found. A global task force is formed to investigate, headed by none other than General Hicks. And General Hicks, if I'm remembering right, he didn't prepare. Yeah, he was Colonel Hicks in the original movie, played by Kevin Dunn, so they're bringing him back. A strange giant egg is discovered in a downtown park of a medium-sized town in New England. When word reaches Hicks of its discovery, he sends in a task force to investigate. The investigators reach the town only to discover it destroyed and its inhabitants vanished without a trace. That's not going to make sense in a few pages. I'll mention that. In the center of town, remnants of the hatched eggs are found. The investigators conclude that somehow, some way, a Godzilla is responsible. Yes, the Godzillas are known for kidnapping people. Remember that happening in the movie? No, I don't either. The nightmare has begun again. General Hicks immediately puts out an APB on Godzilla expert Nick Totopoulos. He has gone from worm guy to Godzilla expert. Even though he's not heading up the research project, he's now the expert. Wedding bells chime outside a small church in Vermont. Nick and Audrey have finally tied the knot. We see that Nick is more or less resigned to his fate. Resigned? This makes it sound like their relationship is way worse than it was. The pair make their way to a waiting limo, showered by handfuls of rice. Nick climbs inside the limo. When Audrey turns to wave at the crowd one last time, the door to the limo suddenly closes, and all the doors lock, trapping Nick inside. The limo speeds away from the stunned crowd and Nick's equally stunned bride. In parentheses, it says, note, this is the first and last we see of Audrey. So they definitely are taking criticism of the first movie and keeping that in mind, because nobody liked that character coming out of it. Like, that character probably got the most shit out of anybody coming out of that movie when it came out. And so she's just written out of this completely, which is kind of funny. And so when Nick shouts for an explanation, the driver turns out to be the Frenchman Philippe Roche. So Jean Reno is back. Sadly, no Hank Azaria is coming back for this. He never appears. He apologizes for the abrupt departure, hands Nick a classified folder detailing the strange events occurring around the world. He reveals that he's working for General Hicks and the Global Task Force, who are convinced that Godzilla is responsible. This would probably get ironed out in an actual script, but nothing about this other than the egg remains screams Godzilla. Even that version of Godzilla. Nick insists even if Godzilla had survived, it couldn't possibly be responsible for the weird events occurring around the world. There are too many inconsistencies. But Philippe is determined to find out one way or another. And should a Godzilla prove to be alive, it must be destroyed once and for all. And that's going to be the last French accent I do. Philippe stops the car and turns to Nick. I need your help. Nick finally agrees to help Philippe in his search, but for very different reasons. Restricting their search to the southern hemisphere because of climate, ocean currents, and relative proximity of the unexplainable events. Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. New England town, proximity to the Pacific Ocean, southern hemisphere. No, that part, like I said, that part makes no sense. Nick and Philippe determine that the only landmass big enough to support a creature of Godzilla's size without fear of detection is Australia. And, you know, the ocean, because Godzilla normally lives down there, but, you know, we're going to paper that part over. That is where they target their search. Deep in the Australian outback, sadly, there is no Crocodile Dundee cameo. Nick and Philippe cross paths with a beautiful and rugged no-nonsense female biologist, in parentheses, Anna Charlton, who claims to be doing research on dingoes, and I'm not going to make the obvious joke. She asks what they're doing in the middle of nowhere. Philippe nods towards Nick. He's on his honeymoon. That's pretty funny. Anna takes an immediate dislike to the pair, especially Nick. I wonder why. Her answers to their questions are curt and brusque. He really likes the word brusque or brusque in this, almost as much as Ian Fleming does in his books, because I've never heard brusque and brusquely used as many times as I have when I read those books. No, she's not seen nor heard anything strange or unusual. She asks them to leave and not disturb her research area. Before they depart, Philippe slips a tracking device into the back of her Jeep. Both Nick and Philippe are convinced she's hiding something. Later, they trail her Jeep further into the rugged outback where they lose her when their own vehicle breaks down. Stranded in the middle of nowhere, arguing, they both suddenly hear a familiar bone-chilling roar. Them getting stranded out in the outback is just making me think of Kangaroo Jack at this point. Grabbing their gear, they race up a nearby bluff and come face-to-face with Godzilla, now full-grown. Hiding in the bushes to avoid detection, Nick and Philippe are even more stunned to discover Godzilla is not alone. The creature has given birth to a brood of young, parentheses, teen Zillas, each nearly three stories high. As Godzilla and its brood stomp into the full view, a pack of dingoes suddenly attack a straggler we will come to know as the runt of the litter. And so this is an interesting idea that I like. If you're going to do a sequel to that, explore what would happen if a brood of Godzillas grew up, or started to grow up. I think that's a cool direction to take it in if you're going to do a sequel to that movie. Smaller and weaker than the others, the runt cries out for help as the dingoes swarm. Godzilla roars, the rest of its young spook. While Godzilla defends the runt from the hungry pack, Nick and Philippe find themselves directly in the path of a Godzilla stampede. And now I'm thinking of the King Kong movie from 2005. Just when we think they're dead meat, a Jeep pulls up and Anna screams for them to get in. It says scream, not screams, I swear. What follows is a hair-raising roller coaster ride of Anna swerving in between the giant tree trunk legs of the stampeding teen Zillas, miraculously avoiding getting squashed, while Nick and Philippe cling to their seats for dear life. Eventually, Anna is able to swerve out of harm's way just as Godzilla comes on the scene carrying the runt on its tail. As calm returns and Godzilla and its brood continues to forage, Anna turns to the astonished Nick and Philippe. Okay, so maybe I have seen something a little unusual. I could see that being a very funny moment. Act 2. Philippe makes for the radio in Anna's Jeep in an attempt to contact General Hicks. Nick pleads with him to wait. They argue. A shot suddenly rings out. The radio shatters. Philippe and Nick turn to find Anna holding a gun on the pair, so she's pretty cool. Anna reveals that she stumbled upon Godzilla over a year ago and has since dedicated herself to studying and protecting the creature with an almost militant determination. She remains hostile towards the pair, especially Nick. Nick tries to convince her that as a fellow scientist, he wants to help preserve the species, not destroy it. He tells Anna he's come to prove that Godzilla and its brood are not responsible for the marauding attacks in the vicinity. The vicinity including New England. I'm sorry, I have a hard time letting that go of that. But Anna refuses to believe him. She recognizes Nick as the person responsible for the first Godzilla's death. Nick has no choice but to come clean. He finally reveals the secret he's kept from Philippe, that he rescued a baby Zilla in New York 2 years before and helped it escape. The same full-grown Godzilla that is now running loose with a brood of its own. Philippe is speechless. He can't believe that Nick would allow one of the creatures to survive, especially knowing how rapidly they multiply. Philippe is determined to carry out his threat of alerting General Hicks. Nick suddenly ducks behind the wheel of Anna's Jeep and roars away. Realizing he has to do something drastic in order to win Anna's trust and prove to Philippe that Godzilla is essentially harmless, Nick swerves the vehicle and drives straight for the towering 50-story creature. Philippe and Anna watch in horror as Nick drives right up to Godzilla. A roar from Godzilla shatters every window in the Jeep. Nick hops out and stands before the giant behemoth. Hey, interesting choice of words considering there was a 50s monster movie called The Giant Behemoth with effects by Willis O'Brien. Godzilla raises a foot, ready to flatten Nick like a pancake, when it suddenly stops short. Something about this particular human is familiar. In a touching scene, Godzilla recognizes its mother and nuzzles Nick affectionately, much to the utter astonishment of Philippe and Anna. Nick turns, yells to the pair, "You see, he's really very gentle." At that moment, Godzilla delivers a welcome home roar that knocks Nick off his feet. So slightly more intense than the roar that Godzilla did at him in the first movie, where he just stands there. Sydney, Australia. Another giant egg larva is discovered on the outskirts of the city. General Hicks mobilizes his troops and heads down under. It literally says down under in caps. Another disturbing message arrives. There's been no word from Philippe or Nick for some time. They seem to have vanished without a trace. Like, that sentence vanishes without a trace when you end it with an ellipsis. In the outback, Nick has a new problem. Godzilla follows him everywhere. And wherever Godzilla goes, its babies are sure to follow. This makes for some amusing situations, especially when Godzilla insists on sleeping beside Nick. That could be very funny. Having won Anna's trust, Nick invites her to study the Zillas up close and personal. She shares some of her findings with Nick, including the fact that a full-grown Godzilla is capable of reproducing only once, and that the size of the brood is determined by the carrying capacity of the land. Which, if you think about it, the brood in the first movie seems kind of big for the carrying capacity of Manhattan, but I'll let it go. You can maybe iron that out in a rewrite. Nick wrestles with his blossoming attraction for Anna. After all, technically he's a married man. And in parentheses, Nick's attempts at contacting his new wife and explaining his whereabouts are continually met with her screaming at him and hanging up. They really do her dirty in this. Like, wow, like, I'm not a big fan of that character either, but they're really treating her like shit in this treatment. During this period, Nick tries to convince Philippe that Godzilla is a docile and non-aggressive creature that attacks only when it's young or threatened. Okay, that's not really consistent, but alright. All three are amazed that the Terranus Godzilla shows its young, especially to the runt. So yes, the runt is basically this treatment's version of Manila, or Godzuki, or whatever, insert whatever baby Godzilla you prefer. It's basically taking that concept, and it actually kind of works here. Nick and Anna are certain they're witnessing the birth of a new natural order, and that Godzilla's next step in an evolutionary process accelerated by the nuclear testing fallout. Philippe is beginning to come around to believe that perhaps there is a place in the world for Godzilla after all. But when Godzilla suddenly steals away one night, leaving its sleeping brood, Philippe once again becomes suspicious. The three follow Godzilla and Anna's jeep some 20 miles to the deserted north coast, where they watch the giant creature disappear into the ocean. Nick is heartsick. Is it possible Godzilla has been making the various raids in order to feed its brood? Are the Zillas being fed a steady diet of human captives? If so, then there'll be no choice left but to destroy them. Suddenly, the ocean is lit up from beneath by bizarre flashes of light. This is actually the first clue we have that this Godzilla can breathe fire, so they're fixing that issue from the first movie of Godzilla not having a breath weapon, instead just blowing on stuff and making it blow up. Schools of tuna swim to the surface. Godzilla explodes out of the water, forcing hundreds upon hundreds of the fish onto the beach. Nick, Anna, and Philippe watch the amazing spectacle as Godzilla continues to herd schools of tuna onto the beach. As dawn approaches, another incredible sight greets them. Godzilla's brood appears on the horizon. Descending on the beach, the hungry Zillas begin gorging on the stranded fish. Nick now has the proof he's come after. Even Philippe has to admit he was wrong, that Godzilla is not responsible for the other attacks. But if not Godzilla, then who? Or better yet, what? In order to answer that question, the trio decide to take a little trip. Monster Island, Godzilla's birthplace. Following Godzilla's death, a clean sweep of the island produced no other biological anomalies. For 2 years, the island has been off limits to visitors, its water heavily patrolled by UN warships. Approaching the island, Nick, Anna, and Philippe don wetsuits and scuba gear in an effort to slip past the blockade. Swimming toward the island, the three are suddenly engulfed by a giant shadow and are stunned to witness a blue whale, three times its normal size, glide silently past. The clean sweep apparently missed a gigantic blue whale. On the island itself, more strange discoveries await, a plethora of new species, some mutated beyond recognition. Even so, there's nothing on the island that seems capable of the kind of destruction being reported around the world. Suddenly, the skies above them darken. A strange buzzing sound fills the air. What seems to be an approaching dark cloud turns out to be a huge swarm of mutated winged insects, equipped with vicious mandibles and deadly wasp-like stingers. And now you folks at home know why Beedrill is in the thumb. Buick-sized insects appear to be carrying something wrapped in their six spiny legs. Nick, Anna, and Philippe watch in horror as the insectoids land and release their human captives. When one man tried to escape, he is immediately set upon and stung to death. Meanwhile, wingless termite-like insects swarm out of an underground nest and heard the I think it's meant to say nest, and heard the human captives underground. Nick, Philippe, and Annas, who somehow were not captured, prepare to follow. Suddenly, horrible screams emanate from the entrance of the underground nest. One by one, they die out until an eerie silence is all that remains. And just when things can't get any worse, the queen bitch emerges from the opening, a huge and ferocious-looking winged insectoid that the other insects flock around, tending to her every need. She is one nasty bug and not above dining on her own kind. As Nick, Anna, and Philippe look on, the queen takes flight and disappears over the ocean, heading for God knows where. A horrible realization sinks in. People are being abducted from around the world and brought to Monster Island to be used by these horrible insectoids. So, we have Godzilla, and we're setting up a monster for it to fight. That is cool. They're definitely... That's something that's actually really cool about this treatment, is that it seems to be taking what the 98 movie did and what a traditional Godzilla movie is and trying to bridge the gap between the two to try and maybe, you know, build bridges with the fandom maybe a little bit. And I think it's mostly successful in doing that. Nick and Anna conclude that Godzilla and its brood are the natural predators of these bugs. But because of man's interference, the natural food chain ? So even Tab Murphy doesn't seem to know what that means. On Monster Island has been disrupted. With no controls through natural predation, aka Godzilla, these insectoids will continue to multiply and spread, threatening the entire world. Somehow Godzilla and its brood must be led back to Monster Island in order to bring the insectoids under control and reestablish order and harmony in the food chain. Philippe suddenly becomes extremely agitated, insisting they return to the outback at once. Nick and Anna are perplexed by their friend's strange behavior. Philippe tells them that Godzilla and its brood are in grave danger. The truth finally comes out. Philippe has tipped off General Hicks and the Global Task Force as to Godzilla's whereabouts. Nick and Anna are stunned. Why would he do such a thing? Besides the obvious, really? Philippe reveals he was frightened by the number of Zillas they encountered. Ironically, he had nightmarish visions of Godzilla's taking over the world, which is what prompted his actions. I'm trying to imagine that being filmed. Like, the vision of Hellboy is the beast of the apocalypse, only it's like a fucking Godzilla sitting on like a burning pile. Nick feels betrayed, he and Philippe fight, Anna breaks it up. I'm trying to imagine Matthew Broderick trying to fight anybody, and it is the funniest shit. She tells him to settle it later, time may be running out for Godzilla. And the world. But they're too late. Nick, Anna, and Philippe return to a scene of agonizing devastation. Zillas lie dead everywhere. The countryside is rutted and pockmarked from explosions. The surprise attack by the Global Task Force has come from ground and air. General Hicks and his troops are advancing on Godzilla and one last baby, the Runt, when Nick, Anna, and Philippe arrive on the scene. Nick races past the troops and missile launchers out towards Godzilla and the Runt, causing Hicks to call a ceasefire. Nick looks around at the carnage, at the valiant fight Godzilla put up to save its babies. With tears in his eyes, Nick turns helplessly to Godzilla. I'm sorry. Fucking Godzilla's eyes is one of heartbreak and betrayal. It roars in anguish before suddenly burrowing underground and escaping with the Runt. Nick stands alone amidst the devastation, feeling sick. Meanwhile, Philippe is congratulated by General Hicks. But Philippe tells the general they've made a terrible mistake. By killing the Zillas, they may have just doomed the rest of the world. Before General Hicks can respond, he receives a message from Sydney. Something bizarre is occurring to the giant egg larva. Act 3. Near downtown Sydney, a huge greenhouse-like enclosure has been built around the larval egg, giving scientists an opportunity to study the strange phenomenon in a controlled environment. And that is giving me vibes of what they did with the Mothra egg in Mothra vs. Godzilla. Intentional nod? Maybe. Not sure. Tanks and missile launchers surround the enclosure as a protective measure against whatever might hatch from the egg. The surrounding downtown area has been evacuated. Nick realizes the egg was laid by the queen and is the first step in what will eventually lead to a worldwide spread of the deadly insectoid. He pleads with General Hicks to destroy it. While the pair argue, the queen bitch makes a sudden appearance, intent on protecting her egg. She quickly lays waste to Hicks's troops garrison. While Nick, Anna, and Philippe run for cover, a familiar figure suddenly bursts up through the pavement. Godzilla. And there, hanging onto Godzilla's tail, the Runt. Godzilla goes up against the queen bitch in a spectacular pitched battle throughout downtown Sydney. So yeah, we're getting a pretty cool fight here. At one point, Godzilla takes a nasty sting in the throat, which temporarily paralyzes it. The Runt goes to help, but is immediately set upon by the vicious queen. That is not me skipping words. That is the treatment. Without hesitation, Anna races forward to aid the Runt. But the queen succeeds in killing the baby and grabbing up Anna, much to Nick's horror. Godzilla comes to and sees its dead baby, roars in anguish before turning on the queen's egg larva and torching it with a burst of atomic fire. That is similar to something that happens in the Fred Dekker script where it finds the dead baby Godzilla and then just freaks the fuck out, which is a great, well-written scene. Wow, the queen bitch screams in rage and takes wing, Anna struggling in its spiny clutches. Nick, Philippe, and Hicks watch as Godzilla dives in the ocean, head for Monster Island in a final showdown with the queen bitch. Gotta love that name, it's ridiculous, but Nick and Philippe put aside their differences in order to go after Anna. General Hicks organizes a military rescue led by a squadron of jet fighters. He jumps into an Apache chopper together with Nick and Philippe. As the chopper lifts off, Hicks remembers to give Nick a note he's been carrying. Nick reads and his face drops even further. Bad news? Asks Philippe. I'm not sure, Nick responds, handing Philippe the note. His marriage has been annulled. That's pretty funny, admittedly. Like, they are committed to undoing that whole part of the movie. Any other movie would just go like, oh, she died in between movies, or they just don't mention her. In this? Nope. Off screen, the whole movie, and then she just goes, eh, divorce. On approach to Monster Island, they are attacked by a swarm of the mutated insectoids. A spectacular battle in the sky follows as the jet fighters take on the insects. This is awesome. But the insect numbers prove to be overpowering. The battle ends with every jet down and the Apache chopper crash landing on the island just as Godzilla wades ashore to take up the attack. Nick, Philippe, and Hicks scramble from the wreckage of the downed chopper as all hell breaks loose. Godzilla is under assault from the flying insectoids above and the wingless termite-like bugs on the ground. Bursts of atomic fire breath incinerate everything within range. While Hicks awaits reinforcements, Nick and Philippe make their way into a maze of deserted underground passageways in search of Anna. The pair stumble upon an enormous underground chamber where hundreds of half-starved human prisoners are being guarded by a handful of wingless insectoids. Using incinerator grenades, Nick and Philippe manage to kill the insect guards. Oh, this sounds like fun. Nick and Anna embrace in an emotional reunion. Philippe, Nick, and Anna begin to lead the others topside when the queen bitch suddenly appears, blocking their way and trapping them inside the underground chamber. The queen bitch advances and is about to devour Nick for lunch when Godzilla suddenly burrows through the cavern wall. Now, I don't remember Godzilla doing too much burrowing in the first movie, but that would explain why he's able to just disappear from sight. Godzilla and the queen bitch square off for one final giant monster battle. Nick, Anna, and Philippe lead the captive people topside as the fight progresses above ground. This time, Godzilla is the victor, vanquishing the queen bitch and bringing natural order back to Monster Island's ecosystem. General Hicks's reinforcements suddenly arrive. They line up their big guns to take out Godzilla once and for all. Godzilla is all but defenseless, spent and exhausted from his battle with the queen bitch. Nick, Anna are so enraged that Hicks orders them put under protective custody. All appears lost. Believing he's doing the right thing for humanity, General Hicks is about to give the order to fire when an extraordinary thing happens. The hundreds of people that have been set free form a protective circle around Godzilla, and there leading the blockade is none other than Philippe. Okay, that's kind of corny. That's a little cheesy, that moment, but it makes sense. It actually reminds me of the ending of Godzilla Final Wars, where they do the, where they like stand for, Minya stands in front of the people and raises his arms like the kid did earlier. And in that moment, General Hicks realizes pulling the trigger on Godzilla would be the wrong thing to do. He orders his troops to withdraw. Loud cheers go up from the people that the Godzilla helped set free. Suddenly, a new sound reaches everyone's ears. Just then, another Godzilla wades onto the shores of Monster Island, calling for its mother. The runt wasn't killed after all. The sight of its baby revives Godzilla, and the pair have a touching reunion. Later, against a brilliant sunset, Nick, Anna, and Philippe say goodbye to Godzilla and the runt as the pair return to the ocean. The end. Overall, I can say I find this treatment to be pretty enjoyable. It does really what it needs to do to be a sequel to the 98 movie, because it still keeps all that stuff canon, still refers back to it, keeps a bunch of the same characters, but it also kind of decides to respect the source material a little more than that movie did by bringing in other monsters, making Godzilla more like the Godzilla from those movies, giving it the fire breath, having it fight the monster, and all this other stuff. But it kind of balances those two, and I think it does that pretty well. The insects are a pretty cool villain for Godzilla. You didn't really see anything, Godzilla fight anything like that, really. And so, like, you have, like, the giant bugs, the giant praying mantises in Son of Godzilla and the giant spider at the end. But you don't really get this idea of Godzilla fighting, like, a swarm with a queen until Godzilla versus Megaguirus. That came out 2 years after this, or, like, a year after this. I think that came out in 2000. And this is better than that, I think, because that movie is just very dull and kind of silly for the most part. Not one of the better Toho Godzilla movies. I think this, for the most part, is better. I like the banter amongst the characters for the most part. I like the arcs. I like how the Runt is basically just a version of the son of Godzilla, but given like an emotional context, and that it is actually Godzilla's child and not just some random cast off egg that hatches. And overall, I just like this. Like, tonally, it is different from the 98 movie. Like, this feels a little bit like a cartoon, which is interesting considering this is from a guy who has written mainly in animation, so I guess that's to be expected. But it does feel like something that would work animated, the way it's described. And the Queen Bitch, while the name is admittedly very silly, they probably could come up with something better than that for the movie. Or they could just not refer to it by name in the movie itself. But no, the action is really good for the most part. The monster stuff is all very cool, and there's quite a bit of it. And the human characters aren't too bad here. Nick is given a little bit more personality, aside from just being the nerdy worm guy. Him having an actual conflict with Philippe is kind of interesting. And Philippe being kind of more of the Knight Templar of the bunch, who's like a bit of an extremist. I think that works. I don't mind Anna as a character from what's on the page, but given that this is just a treatment, she isn't terribly fleshed out. And the whole attraction between her and Nick goes absolutely nowhere. It never comes up again after, like, the halfway point. And the way they handle Audrey is funny, but I think they probably could have done it a little more gracefully without throwing the character under the bus. That is one of my criticisms. And the whole idea of, like, oh, people are getting kidnapped from around the world, and they think a Godzilla is doing it, and somehow no one is noticing, even though it was leaving footprints everywhere in the first movie. That's very stupid. They could find a way to work around that. But yeah, overall, I do think it's a pretty decent treatment that if it was given, you know, the time to be fleshed out into a script, it might have been an all right movie. Now, as to what happened to it, what's interesting is that it sounds like Sony was still kind of wanting to do a sequel, but they were very, very finicky about budget, especially after Emmerich and Devlin went way over the last time. And they seem to disagree with those two guys and their company, Cinetropolis, over budget. And that seems to have killed it entirely. And it may have just been disinterest after the first movie underperformed and the budget was an excuse. But then you have, because it sounds like, because the way Devlin describes it, it sounds like they wanted to do it, but Sony didn't. And then years and years later, there's an interview with Roland Emmerich where he says, oh, I advised them not to do it because everybody expected more from the first movie, something blah, blah, blah. Like, why does it need to have a sequel? Not everything needs a sequel. And I kind of feel like he changed his mind and was saying that to save face later on. Like, it felt very insincere reading it. And I don't really think Emmerich would have enjoyed directing this because, yeah, you get the cool jet planes versus insect stuff at the end. But he never seemed to like the idea of monster fights and adding Godzilla fighting another monster here. Because if you read, like, quotes of him about why he was initially reluctant to do the movie, he never liked Godzilla. And he really didn't like the idea of monsters fighting in the movie. So it almost feels like he wouldn't have wanted to make this. Like, they would have had to find someone else to be, like, the B guy to direct it. Like, maybe let Patrick Tatopoulos direct his first movie. That's just my speculation. But either way, it didn't happen, and Sony kind of dithered. They eventually decided to give Godzilla 2000 its own theatrical release here, and they redubbed it themselves because apparently the dub they were given was terrible, and they talked about doing a sequel to it, like doing their own American-made sequel to Godzilla 2000, because they still had the rights to make more Godzilla movies, and they had the rights up until 2003, and they talked about doing it, and they're going to have like Toho produce the suit effects while they shot the human scenes with Joe Dante directing. And then that fell apart because there was like a regime change and the new people didn't want to do a rubber suit Godzilla movie. So that was that. And then 2003 came and they lost the rights, and eventually Legendary picked it up and they made the MonsterVerse, which is still going now. And it's interesting because the whole idea of Godzilla restoring the natural order ends up being a big thing in those movies. And it's right here in this treatment, which I find very interesting. And another thing I find interesting is because infamously the American Godzilla has a cameo in Godzilla Final Wars and gets killed in about 30 seconds. And apparently the shortness of the fight was less due to it being an FU and more due to the fact that they just didn't have the time to make it longer. And it's also that fight scene, and every scene with that guy, with, you know, the American Godzilla, or Zilla as it's called, they're all set in Australia, in Sydney. Like, this script has scenes set mainly in Australia and some in Sydney. So it would be, it makes me wonder if Toho, like, when they wrote that scene in, if they were like, oh yeah, let's just do the Sydney thing, because that was in the treatment, because they would have seen it. I find that very interesting to speculate about. But yeah, that's actually kind of cool. So yeah, Godzilla 2, It's not exactly a brilliant script or anything. It's not brilliant treatment. It's very silly, very actiony, very cartoony. But at the end of the day, I think this is probably the best you could expect from a sequel to that Godzilla movie. Like, I don't think you're going to do a hell of a lot better than this. Like, this could be improved on, but I don't think you're going to get something that's like a timeless masterpiece or like a brilliant film building off of that first movie's foundation. It's a very flawed foundation for a series, but I feel like this did a lot of course correction, and I'm very curious as to what a third movie could have been, because they were still talking trilogy. And would the third movie have brought in aliens? Would it have brought in other monsters? Because the way this ends, you know, the order of Monster Island is restored, and they say, oh, there's nothing else on Monster Island that could be a threat like the Queen Bitch and the insects are. So it really makes me wonder where that third one would have gone. Would there have been something else from elsewhere would have shown up? Would Monster Island have produced another mutant? Or would they have done aliens? I mean, Emmerich and Devlin have done aliens more than once. But yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about. So yeah, Godzilla 2, not a masterpiece by any means, but after all, it is still just a treatment. But for what it is, I think it's pretty good. So yeah, that should be it for this episode. And until next time, guys, bye.